This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today, I'm talking to Kathleen Schmidt. She is a publishing strategist who I discovered via her really excellent Substack newsletter called Publishing Confidential, which I read fairly carefully and find Kathleen to be really astute and smart about the book business. How are you, Kathleen?
I'm doing well, David. Thank you for having me.
No, I really am glad to have you here. I think what spurred me to talk to you was in December, you published an issue of the newsletter, which kind of summarized what you're thinking about, you know, almost like an end of year summary, looking ahead to 2026. And a lot of the things you talked about were things that I think about all the time and am really happy to hear cogently and coherently written about. And I've been referring people to that issue because it's easier than me trying to explain those things to people. It's better for me to send them to you. Before we talk about ideas and stuff, maybe you could talk a little bit about your history in the book business, you know, what got you here and, you know, whatever you want to say about that.
Sure. I just celebrated my 30th anniversary in the publishing industry, and I've mostly worked in publicity departments. So I started out at an independent publisher called Carroll Publishing in 1996. From there, I went to Pocket Books and was a publicist at Pocket Books, just doing paperback publicity. And then from there, I went to Penguin Putnam when it was Penguin Putnam and then Penguin Group USA to work for Dutton Books, Plume, and the late Gotham Books. That imprint shut down. And I stayed there for a long time. That was my longest job at a company, at a Big Five. I was there for almost 9 years. And then I went to Atria to become the vice president of publicity. And from there, I tried to go out on my own for a couple of years, you know, back in 2010. And I didn't really like it at that time. So I went back in-house at Perseus Books and was a publicity director for Weinstein Books and then the VP for publicity and marketing at Running Press. And then I left there to become associate publisher of Rodale. Then I was a literary agent. Then I was publicity director at Skyhorse. And here I am. So my business has been up and running for 3 years now. In late 2022, I felt very much burnt out from the pandemic. And I felt like I didn't really want to work for a publisher anymore. And I kind of wanted to take a little time to decide what I wanted to do. And the best way for me to move forward was to work for myself because I can have the freedom to write the things that I do in the newsletter without being tethered to a publishing house. And I also get to pick my projects and pick all the kinds of things that I want to do rather than just getting assigned books or just, you know, working on celebrity books or what have you that would often happen to me in-house. So I feel like I'm more in the weeds with authors now than I ever was. And I like it. It's a good feeling.
What would you say are the majority of your projects? You know, do they come to you from authors hiring you or from independent publishers or from big publishers bringing you in to work on a project? What's mostly what you're doing?
It's a mix. I have a big publisher as a client, and then I have some indie publishers. And I love indie publishers. That's where I got my start. I have a soft spot for them. And the rest of them are, you know, they all come to me. They're independent authors. I mean, they're authors who are either published by a big publisher or an indie publisher or what I call a micro press, which is smaller than an indie publisher. But I also have clients who have been published in the hybrid model, which is always interesting. I take on self-published authors very rarely, but sometimes if I really see potential for the project, I'll take them on. But I also help people with book proposals and manuscript reviews, things like that. So it's a very much a variety for me, which I like.
No, I think that's good. Keeps things interesting. And, yeah. You know, as I think working with the authors, you get a much more varied sense, a much deeper sense of each book too.
Not
just assembly line projects. And this sort of goes to one of the things that you talked about, or a couple of things you talked about in the newsletter that I thought were interesting, kind of trying to rethink the idea of publicity. And I think and of marketing, because they actually, you know, are really part of the same area. Maybe you could talk a little bit. I think this is really important for people to understand. I know that kind of inherently people realize that the media world, the media landscape has changed, but I don't know whether it's fully sunk in, you know, how much that requires rethinking what publicity and marketing actually mean, because it's really, it's hard to do them in the first place. But I think people kind of lean back onto tried and true methods because it is so hard, and because what's required now is more a customized, creative, innovative approach to reaching readers. You know, it's search and discovery. You know, it isn't really marketing anymore in the way that people think marketing products is. I mean, it still has those principles, I think. You couldn't deny that, but I think you talked about this.
A lot of people still hold on to the traditional models of publicity and marketing, which the traditional model says that publicity is earned media and marketing is paid media. Those lines are very blurred now because, as I wrote this in this week's newsletter, advertising rarely works for books. And a lot of people argued with me about this, but it's true. I've seen it over the years. I mean, I'm not going to say that, you know, someone should go place a full-page ad in the New York Times Book Review for $77,000. That's somebody's salary, when I know it doesn't work. So what marketing really has become, and publicity, it's really become about reaching the reader directly. And I think a lot of publishers still hold on to the idea that the only way to do that is through a media hit. And that's incorrect, because the media hits don't really get the same traction as, you know, say, an author who is very good at communicating with their readers on some kind of platform or just in real life. I think that, you know, publishers have become sort of over-dependent on the same publicity plans over and over and over, which is something I wrote about in that newsletter too, where you know that some of this stuff is just, you know, blowing hot air, and you're still presenting it to an author like it's viable. And I think that's a really bad idea, because then, you know, it's very aspirational is what I'll say. And not a lot of it becomes true. And then you have a really disappointed author. So my feeling is, why not just be honest and take a look at each book for what it is and tell the author, we are focusing on XYZ because this is where your book will perform. You know, this is where we know you'll reach the readers. And as far as marketing is concerned, I think they're, you know, somewhat over dependent on influencers. And the influencer economy, there are reports that come out from places like Goldman Sachs and what have you that say, oh, the influencer economy is going to be so strong in 2026. It's not. The consumer is very savvy now, and they know that influencers post this stuff on Instagram or TikTok with the intent of having you click on their affiliate link so that they get money. And they're also getting paid by brands to promote whatever. So people are understanding that now. And there's kind of a little bit of a movement happening where no one wants to buy anything. So it's called like a no buy year or something. Nobody buys something new. And there's something to that. I mean, we're in a bad economy, terrible political state, and people are just not going to part with their dollars as easily. And the marketing has to meet people where they're at, I think, emotionally, mentally, and consumer-wise. You know, you want to be relatable to them, and publishing can be very insular and, again, aspirational. So, you know, the messaging from publishers could improve, really, and the marketing has to get more creative in order to move forward and have things work for them.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And, you know, sort of thinking about the influencer thing, I read what you wrote about. I also think that it's sort of similar to other aspects of book marketing insofar as we are competing with books as individual products. There are thousands mm-hmm. of them every year, millions now. And influencers are the ones that are successful are connecting with their audiences personally. And then the products that they're promoting, really, they are promoting, are bigger brands, as you mentioned. It's, yes. you know, they it becomes like, I saw there's some, you know, it's kind of suffused into the cultural landscape. I watched some television show that I won't name that's really good. It's all kind of about influencers. And their world is kind of antithetical to deep connection with yes. human beings. And books are about deep connections to human beings. So
yes.
it just doesn't make sense that in the long run that will work.
No, the thing with influencers is that, you know, consumers who are really, really into them have somewhat of a parasocial relationship with them. So they think that they know the person, and that's not the case at all. You know, that influencer probably could care less, you know, about you and your money and what's going on in your life. So I do find that authors who are very good at connecting with readers online tend to have more success. And I saw that on Twitter as well, early days of Twitter, not late days of Twitter. But I saw that in the early days of Twitter that, you know, there were a couple of authors who were very good on there and would respond to people. The issue, I think, with some writers is that, you know, writing is such a solitary activity and a solitary job that they're in their head so much that it's hard for them to break out of that and be chatty with people. And, you know, my whole career is based on talking to other people, so I don't have a problem with that. But I do tell authors, you know, you really have to participate and at least try, because a lot of them think, you know, they put a lot of pressure on themselves to post the perfect thing or the perfect image or, you know, a picture of an aspirational life. That's not really what they should be doing. They should show a snapshot of, you know, of reality, of what their life is like a little bit, just enough so that the reader feels like they can relate to you. And answer people's, you know, people who comment, answer them. I know for myself, on Substack, on Instagram, on Threads, when people comment, I try to get to everybody. And like either, you know, I like it with a little heart or I answer or something like that, because you have to keep that relationship. And that's how I've been able to build my followings. So I try to instill that in authors as well.
Although I think, I'm sure you've had this response, and I think it's many authors will say it's just, it's not for them. It's not what they want to do.
Yes.
But then the question is really, okay, let's assume social media and, in, you know, kind of that form of relating online isn't available in many cases of books. What mm-hmm. kind of, I think when you talked about earlier about being creative, I think that's the part that is so difficult for everyone. You know, authors are looking for someone to say, okay, you don't have to be social, but what can we do? You know, what, not just the author, but what can everyone involved, publisher, marketer, author, actually do to find those readers that are the people that you think will be interested in this book?
Well, one thing that people can do, that authors can do, is find themselves a really good digital surrogate. And I crafted that term because a digital surrogate is someone that an author already has a relationship with who is on social and does have a decent following on social and can post about their book for them. So that's one part of it. Another part of it is, and I wrote about this too, I really would love to see more imprints at publishers on Substack doing media newsletters to reach readers. Because what happens now is the newsletters are generated from the publisher's, you know, own website, own system, and they're too much like, you know, yeah, advertising.
Well, it's like catalog. They're like writing catalog copy.
Yeah, exactly. When you get on Substack, and you know, there are endless possibilities with that too. I mean, they could have one of their authors from an imprint guest post for them. You know, it's a lot of different things. And if they would just take the time to do that and have authors on their lists, and I'm not talking about, you know, Penguin Random House having a newsletter. I'm talking about an imprint inside of Penguin Random House having its own newsletter. Then you get to know, you know, you could get to know the editors, you can get to know the list, and you feel more of a connection. And I feel that's what people are craving now. They want, you know, they want something meatier. And I think that's why Substack has blown up so much too. And you know, I think, you know, for marketers in-house, it's hard because they have to follow budgets. They have to follow, and publicity has to do the same thing. The word comes down from the top for them and what they should be doing for each of the books on an imprint list. And they're kind of prisoners of budgets. And, you know, it's not exactly a secret that marketing and publicity departments and editorial departments in publishing are woefully understaffed at all times. So it's a real conundrum. But I think what my point is in that particular newsletter is that if they shifted their energy towards something like this and took it away from something that doesn't sell books, then, you know, maybe there wouldn't be a problem.
There was something else you wrote about. Now, this is kind of inside baseball for people who are listening. This is really about how the publishing business works. And that is, almost every publisher or distributor who works with independent publishers, the sales department leans on the marketing and publicity people and asks them to pre-plan and share, yes, those plans as a way of gauging the impact of the book, so mm-hmm. they can talk to their customers who are, yeah, booksellers, maybe the buyer at a large retail chain, wholesalers. And all of it is kind of condensing down. I mean, the whole mm-hmm. process is one of taking, and this is sort of what's awful about it. A book might take 2 or 3 years to write. In a sales presentation, it's about 5 minutes or 3 minutes. And in right. a marketing plan, you know, you've got like almost nothing there other than bullet points to try right. to explain how this book fits, what it is, you know, comps, comparative titles, which is a yep. kind of ludicrous idea.
And it is.
What you said in your newsletter, which I thought was really important, is that the sales structure has not kept up with the changes in the world of media, and they right. keep expecting, you know, if you say Wall Street Journal will review this book, that's like a big deal. But in fact, it's not.
And it's not.
So it's not just that marketing and publicity has to change. It's also that the sales process has to change. And in fact, the sales process has to change because the customer base is different and the way retail works is different now than it was when all these systems were invented or evolved. And so right. I thought what you said was really important, but this will only resonate for people inside the book business.
Right. But authors should also know that it kind of hasn't changed. I remember when I was working at Atria between 2006 and 2010, there was a point in between there that Barnes & Noble went to the president of sales at Simon & Schuster at the time and said they wanted publicity plans for books 18 months in advance. Like, what? I mean, it is ridiculous. And it's all based on BS. I mean, those plans are so dodgy sometimes that it's just to appease people. And I just don't see the point. It would be like me sending people, potential clients, proposals that had pie in the sky stuff on it, and me saying, pay me, a boatload of money because I'm going to send out all these emails and I'm not going to get an answer from most people. I mean, the Wall Street Journal saying, a book is going to be reviewed in a Wall Street Journal. I don't know how sales departments don't see that that is not selling a book, that a review in the New York Times is not selling a book like it used to sell a book. So stop asking for those things, and get with the program and understand that, an impact can be made from an author doing a ton of mid-size or small podcasts or being featured in newsletters. The whole mentality needs to change because it's just not working the way it is.
Right. But it also kind of goes to the fact that almost no one really knows when books work, how that happened.
Right.
there is something going on that I read an article about, I can't remember who this was. I wish I could remember the author's name. He was an older author who did his first book at about 75 and originally self-published it and turned it into—
Is it Theo of Golden? Yeah, I'm reading that right now. It's great.
Is it really good?
Yeah, it is really good. It's a slow-paced book. So, if someone is looking for a quick read, that's not it. But I'm savoring it because it is so good. And there's a maturity in the writing that you often don't get with someone on the younger side. And I think there's a whole demographic that can appreciate that. And again, I feel like sometimes publishers miss the mark, with thinking that everyone wants quick and, they want to consume and be done. That's not necessarily true. And that's proven by this book being such a big bestseller, word of mouth. Theo of Golden.
Right. And it wasn't an accidental mysterious thing. I mean, when you kind of break down what happened, it was about word of mouth and it was about a certain amount of surrogacy where people who were friends of the author read the book and loved it so much that they told other people, you have to read this book. And, I've always thought word of mouth is really all there is. It's what we care about the most is somebody telling you, you need to read this. You need to see this show. You're much more inclined to do that. The closer the relationship, the more likely it is that you will actually take their advice and do it because you care about them and you believe them.
Yeah. My rule is if I see or hear about a book three times in a week, then I need to buy it and read it. And that's been my rule for a long time. And I held out on Theo of Golden for a while. And then the surge started. I kept seeing it mentioned, in Facebook posts from my friends, or or just on threads or in a newsletter or something. And I was like, fine, I'll read it. And it's a delightful surprise. I think that the publisher was probably slightly caught off guard by that, but from what I understand, the editor very much championed it, which is also important. But to your point, I mean, word of mouth still rules. And the question is, how do you get word of mouth? And the answer is by a swell of different things. You know, it could be by someone posting about your book. It could be that someone heard about your book on some random podcast that they listened to and decided that their book club is going to read it. I think what happened with Theo of Golden is that a lot of book clubs started picking it up. And that created this like groundswell of support for the book. But I think that people have to remember, you know, that there is a medium that consumers hear about things. And that medium can be a newsletter, it could be a podcast. What it's not usually is a book review. And that's not to say that book reviews don't have their place, because they absolutely do. I think the, you know, work of book critics is really important, but it's reserved for particular books, and we can't deny that. So I think, you know, people just have to understand moving forward that, you know, if they don't try, you know, if they don't try to at least connect with the reader, then they're not doing everything they can to promote their book.
And that kind of goes to another thing you mentioned that I wanted to ask you about. You said that you think that in-person events may not be as dead as some people think they are. And maybe you could expand on that a little bit, and kind of, because it is also like what we were talking about, the direct connection with readers and it used to be really important.
Yes, for sure. So what's happening right now is that literary retreats are becoming very popular, reading retreats. I went on one in November to see what it was like, and it was really nice. I met a group of women I didn't know from anywhere. We spent the weekend together. It was very out of my comfort zone, because I'm usually like, I don't want to talk to anybody that I don't know over the weekend. But it was a really great way to spend a weekend reading and talking about the same book. And those are popping up quite a bit. There's also this phenomenon right now called the Silent Book Club, where people gather in certain spaces and they read whatever they want. It's just gathering and reading for a couple of hours. And I think people really crave that kind of community. You know, I myself just, you know, got invited to an author dinner next Friday night by someone who throws author dinners. And I think that I'm going to go, because why not? You know, the thing is that a lot of people are so over the whole Zoom thing and staying home and all of that, that they crave community, especially book lovers who want to talk about books. I mean, you know, BookCon is coming back this year in the spring, and they sold out very quickly. So I think personally that if Book Expo were to come back, it would be strong, because people still want that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think the more the world becomes disconnected, the more people want connection.
And 100%.
As you alluded to, this is a very difficult time. We need our communities. We need the people that we can relate to give us some sense of humanity and hope that the world is not completely dead or dying. And I think that's really important, because it has nothing to do with, I mean, not directly with the politics, but it is indirectly about what's going on in our world.
Yes, it is. And I think that, you know, times are especially fraught right now. And what do you do when times are fraught? You look for community. You know, during the lockdowns, that was much harder to do, but people rallied and would, you know, have cocktails over Zoom or, you know, just have, you know, have people sit in their backyard, have their neighbors over. There is always a craving for connection. And that's something to really tap into. Two things can be true at once. Reading can be solitary, but also reading is very much community. So you can still read your own book and be with other people, or you can all read the same book and discuss it. And if that's not, you know, if that's not your thing, then the silent book club is probably a good idea if you want to be around people and you don't want to talk, but you just want a feeling that you're part of something. That's a great thing to do.
Yeah, I would imagine whether it's fiction or nonfiction, people are, if you're interested in a subject, you want to talk to people who also are interested in that subject. I mean, I can come up with infinite numbers of examples. You know, if you like baseball, you really like to talk about baseball.
Yeah, and exactly.
If you like romance novels, talking yes. to other people who read romances can be both validating, but it's also you get to talk about the characters. You get to talk about the stories yes. and compare notes and see who you like and, you know, which writers you think are better than other writers. You know, that's a big part of this. And, you know, yeah. getting people together in person, I think, is really powerful. I think it has to be organic. I don't think that someone's going to, you know, walk out the door and say, okay, we're going to figure this out. But I think it is happening.
Yeah, it is. And I think what I see is the romance community is really, really good at community. And they're a good, it's a good genre to study of how authors connect with readers, because I have my favorite romance authors. I am, you know, I follow them on Instagram. I'm on their Facebook, in their Facebook groups, and they have a captive audience there and they do really well. So I think, you know, if someone wanted to know what to do, go look at what some romance authors are doing and, you know, apply it to what your book is.
I think also sci-fi is another category.
100%. Sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, yeah. true crime, any yeah. like specific genre like that. It just can't be like, oh, commercial fiction or literary fiction or women's right. fiction. Those are broad, well, broad categories.
Well, no, the literary fiction does have communities as well, but they tend to be in the bigger cities where there are more people who are interested in them and yes. can gather around, you know, like a particular bar where there are readings
yes.
or something like that. We have a new bookstore, and she has set up with other local businesses to do book clubs.
Oh, that's
like
smart.
In their local coffee shop. They're interested yeah. in science fiction. So they're organizing their own science fiction club where you can come and have a cup of coffee and talk about books.
That's very cool.
That I think is really cool. And I think that we need more kind of innovation like that from people who are just interested in reading.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that sometimes authors get scared about putting themselves out there like that, but I encourage it because that's the only way this stuff happens. You know, what is the worst someone can say to you? No, I'm okay.
Well, they could tell you they don't like your book or they wish you'd.
Not everyone's going to like your book and not everyone's going to say they like your book. So you kind of have to, you know, put on a tougher skin before, yeah.
well, it is,
before
it
you
is,
go out there.
I'm very sympathetic to authors, you know, and their, you know, the kind of fear of the social environment. I think it's really brave to write and publish a book and put yourself out in public in the first place. So, but no, I get what you're saying. There is one other thing I wanted to ask you about before we run out of time. You mentioned AI. Everyone uh-huh. has to address AI. So I want to hear about what you think will AI can be useful for in your work and in, you know, in general, how it can help, because there have to be ways we can use it to be efficient and positive and try to fend off the things that are not going to be so positive.
I use AI and, you know, there are people in publishing who absolutely won't use it, but I'm here to say that it makes my life a lot easier because I run my business solo and you can have AI, make you digital assets. Like, you know, if you want something a little fancier for a book cover, for something to post on Instagram, it does it like that. You know, if you're having trouble coming up with talking points or need like a spreadsheet filled with something, that's the way to go. It just saves a lot of time and that can't be denied and it's not going away. You know, do I think that books, you know, written with AI are a good thing? No, I don't, because you lose the, you know, there's a craft to writing. And, you know, some people think they could just give AI the idea and then AI writes it. And then, you know, you self-publish it on Amazon and it's just slop. And you have to think about, like, what are you attaching your name to? Because I would not want to attach my name to something like that. So I do think one of several areas where AI can become a problem for publishing is in the nonfiction realm, because it's so easy for people to just ask Claude or Perplexity or ChatGPT a question on a topic. I mean, now ChatGPT has ChatGPT Health, which I think is very scary. So you have people like, you know, instead of going to pick up a book, they're asking AI the question. But my theory on that is that those are people who would not read the book anyway. You know, readers are readers and they'll still read books. And I do see, interestingly enough, I do see with Gen Z, I don't see in, you know, with my kids or with friends' kids, they're not really jumping on the AI bandwagon as much as adults think they are. They use it very sparingly, and that's a good thing. But I do think, you know, it is problematic that they're, you know, what Anthropic did and, you know, with all the books that Meta uploaded. I mean, you just can't take people's intellectual property. That's just not right. And the Authors Guild is doing great work putting guardrails up. Agents are doing great work. You know, there needs to be things in contracts. Publishers are fighting the good fight. So I think there's a place for AI in the publishing world, but I don't think it should be used for creating book covers or for content in books, because you don't know where it's pulling stuff from.
Yeah, I haven't seen yet a good AI cover. I get the idea of using it for maybe inspiration or for ideas. I think, you know, what you're basically saying is use it as a tool when it can help you save time in a practical way. But as I think we mostly agree, not for any kind of creative work. Although I suppose one could, I mean, this is what we're going to find out, is use AI to help create an outline. You still write the book. What's the story there? Is that legitimate or not? Nobody really has, you know, we haven't really figured that out yet. It's not easy to visualize the outline for your nonfiction book or something.
No, and I think that AI can help get you started with that. But I would think that, you know, whoever's writing a nonfiction book, if it's, you know, topic driven, they need to be an expert in that topic. Here's where AI can't replace an author. You know, the author still needs to know their subject inside and out in order to do interviews. And that's whether you're on a podcast, whether it's mainstream media, whether it's in a newsletter. It's just like, you know, I read this really good op-ed when AI first started to explode by a professor. And I was like, I'm not going to stop my students from using AI because they're the ones that still have to go out to the professional world and know what they're talking about. And if they use AI, they're not going to know what they're talking about if the computer's not in front of them. And I thought he was absolutely right for that, you know? So
I think that's a good lesson. One last thing I'm going to tell you. You asked for you want to have a really good glossy magazine. And I just happened to read, and you probably, your newsletter was picked up and run by Bo Sachs in his newsletter. And
that's nice.
Yeah. He happened to write about a new glossy magazine that I'm really interested in seeing called Geezer. And it's for aging Gen Zers. I'm past Gen Z, but I'm aging. So why not? It's a glossy magazine that is I think $120 a year, 4 issues or 6 issues or something.
Oh, cool. And okay.
It sounds really good. So
yeah, I'll have to look at it.
You might like it. Well, we could probably do this for a long time, so we may have to do it again and talk about other things, because you are a font of knowledge, and I think it's really interesting to talk to you. So thanks for doing this.
Thanks, David.
And I hope we'll do it again.
Yeah, me too.
This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing business. I've been talking to Kathleen Schmidt. Thank you for listening.